Great to be back in Abilene. I was here yesterday for the exuberant performance of Sing Song by the greatest students in the world. And I stood here with several thousand people with tears in my eyes as we sang, "The Lord Bless You and Keep You." And I thought, only in Abilene. What a unique week. What a unique combination. What a unique school. How great to be home again and to be a part of this great forum. I drove into this city in September of 1965 and parked my beat-up 56 Plymouth at that curb out there in front of the administration building, walked up into the administration building to the office of Bill Hilton, and said, "I'm Jerry Rushford from Detroit, Michigan, and I want to serve the church. I want to get a master's degree in Bible from this school." And I pulled out my wallet and I said, "I've got $48 in my wallet. I don't have any money in the bank. I'm willing to borrow whatever you'll loan me. I'll work for whatever you'll let me work for, but I want to go to school here." He could have laughed me out of his office, I suppose. But he said, "Well, the first thing you need is a room." He showed me a stack of cards for the available housing. I looked at the top card. It said, J.D. Thomas. I said, "I think I know that name." I took the card and walked across the street, met Brother Thomas, said, "I'd like to rent a room for a month." He said that would be $28. That's what they were going for in those days. So I gave him $28. I came back. I said, "Brother Hilton, I'm down to 14. But I still want to go to school here. I'm good for a month now. I've got a room across the street." And you know, this school worked with me patiently. They helped me secure a loan from the First National Bank. I was awarded a W.R. Smith scholarship. A little church out here on the Cap Rock out by O'Donnell agreed to let me come out and preach for them for $25 a Sunday. And Bill Wall gave me a job driving a truck for his one-hour Martinizings, one of the laundry trucks around the city. My parents helped me all they could, and I ended up staying 3 years instead of one. When I finished that MA degree, I stayed on for the Master of Divinity degree. And when I drove out of here in the summer of 1968, as I headed out 80, I thought to check my wallet and was surprised and delighted to find that I had $52 in my wallet as I drove out of town. So in my 3 years here at Abilene, I gained 2 master's degrees and $10 overall in my public fortune, drove off to preach in Michigan. It's great to be back. Will you give your attention to the reading of Holy Scripture? "For what we preach is not ourselves, but Jesus Christ as Lord, with ourselves as your servants for Jesus' sake. For it is the God who said, 'Let light shine out of darkness,' who has shone in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Christ. But we have this treasure in earthen vessels, to show that the transcendent power belongs to God and not to us. We are afflicted in every way, but we are not crushed. We are perplexed, but we are not driven to despair. We are persecuted, but we are not forsaken. We are struck down, but we are not destroyed." So wrote Paul to the Corinthians in describing the difficulty and danger of the apostolic mission. But in the midst of those phrases, he said something else. He gave us a principle A principle that out of great adversity and suffering, much is accomplished. Reading between the lines, he was saying that if there had not been those difficulties, if there had not been that adversity, the church might not have spread as fast as it did. The Bible says Jesus learned obedience by the things that he suffered. And so do we. And so Paul writes, we do not want you to be ignorant, brethren, of the affliction we experienced in Asia. For we were so utterly, unbearably crushed that we despaired of life itself. Why, we felt that we had received the sentence of death, but that was to make us rely not on ourselves, but on God who raises the dead. He delivered us from so deadly a peril, and he will deliver us. On him we have set our hope that he will deliver us again. And so when he got around to describing to these Corinthians the affliction that he called his messenger from Satan, his thorn in the flesh, he admits, three times I besought the Lord about this, that it should leave me. But he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. So Paul concludes, I will all the more gladly boast of my weaknesses, that the power of Christ may rest upon me. For the sake of Christ, then, I am content with weaknesses, insults, hardships, persecutions, and calamities. Here comes the principle now. For when I am weak, then I am strong. In the fall of 1851, George and Elizabeth Prentice were living in the sunshine of life. Annie and Eddie, their children, were healthy, and a third child was on the way. But in November of that year, Eddie contracted a disease, and in December, he was much worse. And in January, the little three-year-old boy died. It was almost more than the family could bear. But 3 months later, they rejoiced when Bessie was born in April. But 1 month later, in the month of May, with only a few hours' notice, she suddenly died. And one night as they came back from the cemetery, having placed flowers on the garden spot of their two little children, Elizabeth broke down and said to George, I don't understand why this is happening to us. We have served this church in New York City for years. We have been good and faithful servants. I don't understand why God is doing this to us. I don't believe that he loves us anymore. And George replied, Elizabeth, do you remember when our children were sick? Do you remember in those moments how we put our arms around them and we loved them even more than we had ever loved them before? Oh, we always loved them. But do you remember how we loved them more when they were hurting? She nodded that she did. We have to convince ourselves now, he said, that God loves us more than he has ever loved us before, that he is here, that he is near, that his arms are around us. Elizabeth, you have got to find ways to love him back. Love him back. He excused himself. He had some calls to make. She sat there in their home in New York City on that historic night in May of 1852, idly thumbing through the hymn book. She came to the hymn that is on page 448 in our hymn book. She began to read it. It was Sarah Adams' hymn. She read it several times, the hymn about Jacob, and she thought how wonderful it would be if she could meet Jacob under those kinds, if she could meet God under similar circumstances as Jacob did, who met God in a situation that was so timely. And after a while, the cadence of the hymn came down to her. She began to get the rhythm of it. She began to see the metric pattern of it. And as she quoted those words, nearer my God to thee, nearer to thee, she began to write her own words, which are on page 148. You might hold them both open at the same time and see how they compare. And that night in the darkness of her living room, as she looked at Sarah Adams' hymn and noticed the cadence to it, she began to write in halting words, more love to thee, O Christ, more love to Thee. Hear Thou the prayer I make on bended knee. This is my earnest plea. More love, O Christ, to Thee. She thought it was awfully simple. She folded it up and put it in a drawer. Forgot about it for 17 years. Saw it accidentally in 1869. Showed it to her husband and said, "Do you remember that night when I said that God doesn't love us anymore? And you told me that I had to love Him back. I wrote these words." She showed them to him. He said, "Elizabeth, this is good. We ought to print them." And he insisted on sending them forth in a pamphlet. And the following year of 1870, they were picked up in a hymn book. And 8 years later at her funeral, those words were sung at her funeral. After she died, George Prentice put out a book of memoirs about his wife. He remembered that night when they came back to the house. And this is what he wrote. "Although the death of these two children tore with anguish the mother's heart, she made no show of grief, and to the eye of the world, her life soon appeared to move on as before time. Never again, however, was it exactly the same life." Here's the line I will never forget in that book. "She had entered into the fellowship of Christ's sufferings, and the new experience wrought a great change in her whole being." She had entered a new world, the world of the sufferings of Christ. She identified with it, and out of that suffering came the hymn. And the point I make to you tonight is that if she had always lived in the sunshine, if life had always treated her great, we would not have that hymn in the book. It was the fruit of suffering. It was the fruit of adversity. In the midst of her greatest pain, she served you and me and generations yet unborn on a night when she was all alone. And so Paul says, "When I was weak, then I was strong." Arthur John Gossip certainly knew that. He lived in the sunshine all of his life, in love with his wife and 5 healthy children, preaching at Beech Grove Church in Aberdeen, Scotland. Sent his wife off for minor surgery that day in 1927, but she did not come back. And when she suddenly died that week and they had the funeral, much to the surprise of his church, he stood before his people the very next Sunday, and he said to them, "I don't think any of you will deny my right to speak today. I have spoken to you in the sunshine of my life, and now today as I walk through the valley, I feel that I owe it to you, my people, to speak and to reaffirm to you my faith in God." And so on that occasion, he preached a sermon entitled, "But When Life Tumbles In, What Then?" One of the great sermons of the 20th century, a sermon that so moved Batzel Barrett Baxter that he wrote a book of that same title, "When Life Tumbles In." But when life tumbles in, what then? He thought of that great book that was written in Bedford Jail. When John Bunyan gave us Pilgrim's Progress, he thought of that memorable scene when Hopeful and Christian came to the River Jordan. They had been journeying from the city of destruction. They were on their way to the city of light. They could see the gates across the way. They asked the angels, "Is there no other way but across the river?" And they got the answer, "You must cross the Jordan," symbolic of death. Hopeful charged into the waters, and he made his way into the depths. Christian started across, but the billows overflowed him. He lost his footing. He panicked and thought that he was perishing. But after a while, Hopeful got to the other side. And as he turned, he yelled back to Christian, "Be of good cheer, my brother. Be of good cheer, for my feet have touched the bottom and it is sound." Arthur John Gossip remembered that scene. And so on that great occasion, as he preached to his people, when he came to a close, he ended with this line, "I don't think you need be afraid of life. Our hearts are very frail, and there are places where the road is very steep and very lonely. But we have a wonderful God. And as Paul puts it, what can separate us from His love? Not death," he says immediately. Pushing that aside at once is the most obvious of all impossibilities. No, not death. "For standing in the roaring of the Jordan, cold to the heart with its dreadful chill, and very conscious of the terror of its rushing, I too like hopeful, can call back to you who one day in your turn will have to cross it. Be of good cheer, my brother, for I feel the bottom, and it is sound. I tell you, it's no surprise to me that a biographer of Arthur John Gossip says of that sermon and of that week in his life, through suffering, he became a better and more helpful servant of God. Of course he did. Out of the crisis of suffering come the great hours of a man's life. I love this hymn book. I've grown up on this hymn book. And I'm happy to say that not all of the great hymns in this book were written in the sunshine. Not all were written in moments of triumph. Not all were written on the mountaintop. We have a great many hymns that were written at great cost, out of deep agony and pain, by the servants of God who, in the midst of their adversity, served us yet. The oldest memory I have of that little brick church building in Biggers, Arkansas, in the northeast corner of the state, is singing from this book. Papa Bill Johnson was our song leader, and a great one. I can see him now belting those songs out. His daughter, my babysitter, Irene Johnson Gatewood, is here this week, married to Otis Gatewood now, and I can still see Irene's dad up there belting them out from Great Songs of the Church, number 2. And when my family moved to Detroit, Michigan, and we were members of the Strathmore Church for all of those years, this was our hymn book, and in my teenage years, I knew every number and knew most of the words by heart. When I went off to Great Lakes Christian, this was the book. Michigan Christian, this was the book. Oklahoma Christian, Abilene, all those little churches. I was 24 years old and preaching in Hazel Park, Michigan, before I realized there was another book. And by then, it was too late. I was hopelessly in love with this one. These were the numbers I loved that I could call out in my sleep. This book came out in 1936. It will soon be 50 years old. But do you know that if all goes well, a year from tonight, on this very night, the new hymn book will be premiered by Abilene Christian University Bookstore. It's going to be a great book. We need to get behind President Teague and tell him that we'll order that new book and that they need to spend the money, and it's going to be a lot of money, but it's going to be a beautiful book. I hope my children and my grandchildren will love that hymn book as much as I've loved this one. It's been a great half century. We can set it aside. We know some more hymns. Now it's time for a new one, and a new one will come forth next year. But, oh, a lot of sentimental attachment to this one. Several years ago, I got interested in the history of hymns in this book, and I started finishing every sermon by telling the history of a hymn. And then in 1982, when I was living in Europe, I began traveling through Europe to find the places where the hymns that were written out of adversity were actually penned. And so I went to Coburg because I had seen the hymn on page 326 in this book, and I marched around that fortress at Coburg in Germany. And I thought of Martin Luther there for 6 months in 1530. The Pope Clement VII was out to get him. Charles V, the Holy Roman Emperor, was out to get him. The cause was looking bleak. Philip Melanchthon was representing him at Augsburg. He was on trial there. Luther couldn't go any further than Coburg or he wouldn't be safe. I went into his rooms there and saw where he sat. I marched around that truly magnificent fortress where he lived those 6 months. And then I began to understand the setting and how he could write, "A mighty fortress is our God, a bulwark never failing, our helper he amid the flood of mortal ills prevailing." And I love this second stanza. "Did we in our own strength confide, our striving would be losing. Were not the right man on our side, the man of God's own choosing. Dost ask who that may be? Christ Jesus, it is he, Lord Sabaoth his name, from age to age the same, and he must win the battle. Not me. The resources are not my own. I am not sufficient for it, but I know where the sufficiency is. The sufficiency is in God." And so I went to Bristol to see Charles Wesley's home, to see his rooms, to try to relive again 1739, when he wrote page 422, when, as he tells us, he was going through a great crisis in his life, Jesus, lover of my soul, let me to thy bosom fly. And then I got on the boat and took the ferry out to find that little town of Inelin. The house is still there, and the study is there, where number 466 was written on June the 6th, 1882. I was there 100 years later, and I sat in that room, and I thought of that blind preacher, George Matheson, who wrote that hymn. He describes what he was going through when he wrote it in these words. My hymn was composed in the manse of Inelin on the evening of June 6th, 1882. I was at that time alone. It was the day of my sister's marriage, and the rest of my family were staying overnight in Glasgow. Something had happened to me which had caused the most severe mental suffering, and this hymn was the fruit of that suffering. I especially like this third stanza. O joy that seeketh me through pain, I cannot close my heart to thee. I trace the rainbow through the rain and feel the promise is not vain, that morn shall tearless be. And the last one, O cross that lifteth up my head, I dare not ask to hide from thee. I lay in dust life's glory dead, and from the ground there blossoms red life that shall endless be. I thought of Henry Francis Light when I looked at 327, how he went to that little fishing village in Brixham in 1823 and gave them 24 years of his life. But nothing that he produced in those years of sunshine have survived, in those years of ease. But when he contracted tuberculosis in the summer of 1847 and knew that he was about to die, a remarkable thing happened on the first weekend in September. He suddenly rallied and announced to his startled daughter and the rest of the family members that he was going to church on Sunday. He hadn't been able to go in months. Not only that, he was going to preach. And preach he did. He took as his text 1 Corinthians 11. He preached on the Lord's Supper. And he stood up on September 5, 1847 and preached that sermon. And then he presided at the Lord's table. And then he went home to Berryhead House, his home overlooking the sea. It's still standing there. Following tea, he walked on the rocks and went down by the coast there, according to Charles Potter, his gardener, who told this story in the British Weekly. He looked out and watched the sun setting over distant Dartmoor in a blaze of glory. He thought of the fact that he had little time to live and that all around him, all he could see was change and decay. And sitting there, he was moved to write, "Abide with me. Fast falls the eventide. The darkness deepens. Lord, with me abide. When other helpers fail and comforts flee, help of the helpless, oh, abide with me." I've always loved 384, and I went all the way to Olney just to see where William Cooper lived. He had to carry a burden that few of us have to carry. He battled insanity all of his life, and he tried to commit suicide in 1773, but his life was spared. And the next year, in a remarkably lucid moment, a moment of great luminosity, he went into his backyard to that little shed back there, that little cottage that is still standing, and he sat down on that bench and wrote, "God moves in a mysterious way his wonders to perform. When I am weak, then I am strong." Look at verse 2. Deep and unfathomable mines of never failing skill, he treasures up his bright design. This line that has come to mean so much to me, "Ye fearful saints, fresh courage take, the clouds ye so much dread are big with mercy and shall break in blessings on your head." And number 5, his purposes will ripen fast, unfolding every hour. The bud may have a bitter taste, but sweet will be the flower. And on to Sheffield to see where James Montgomery wrote In the Hour of Trial, and on through England, hymn after hymn, written out of great adversity and difficulty, but hymns that have given me and you strength and courage. And out of all of that came this feeling that there is a principle here. There is a principle that makes me say that Beethoven wrote music that was even greater than it would have been because he was deaf and he couldn't hear it. And that John Milton wrote poetry that was greater than it ever could have been because he was blind and could not see what he was writing. And these great poets wrote better than they knew because they wrote out of their pain, they wrote out of their limitations, they wrote out of their adversity. When I am weak, then I am strong. The Hebrew writer in that classic document tries to somehow instill strength into his people. In chapter 10, he tells them to draw near to God. In chapter 11, he walks them down the hall of fame and shows them all the great heroes of faith. I'd like to do that to you. We don't have time. I'm writing a book on the history of the church in California. And in the 1890s, when the cause almost died in that state, when virtually every church was lost in the tragic division with the disciples of Christ, and when the conservatives were about to give up, one man in the north and one man in the south held it together. G.W. Winter, up at the little church of Forestville, for 39 years preached for that little church in Forestville and rode all over Northern California and kept the lights gleaming. And down in the southern part of the state, Michael Sanders, who had moved out from Kansas and had such a burden to bear. His wife was not only a Christian, she was quite a critic. His only child, a son, was a very, very hostile to the Christian faith. The church was being lost in Los Angeles. Not many were left. Michael Sanders decided to light a candle instead of curse the darkness. He got a hold of an evangelist named T.B. Larimore, and he asked him to come to Los Angeles. He said, "I'll pitch a tent for you if you'll come." And true to his word, when Larimore showed up, Michael Sanders bought a tent. The meeting started on January 3, 1895. It ended on April 17. For 3.5 months it went. Larimore preached twice every day and three times on Sunday, 15 times a week for 3.5 months. 120 precious souls were baptized into Christ, and the cause got a new breath of life. 5 years later, Sanders went on a train to Nashville to meet David Lipscomb and said, "Show me a young man here who will come to California." Lipscomb introduced him to G.W. Riggs. Riggs said, "I still have 2 years of school left, but if you'll wait on me, I'll be there." He showed up in 1903. Michael Sanders pitched the tent and they preached. In 1910, Sanders gave a lot for the building of the Sitchell Street Church, the mother church for all the churches we have in the greater Los Angeles area. And when he died in 1915, the very last act he did before he died was to write a check for $100,000 by which he gave his estate to the preaching of the gospel and to mission work in Los Angeles. And G.W. Riggs used that money for the next quarter of a century to establish 18 different congregations. Oh, I almost got talking about church history there for a minute. When we are weak, then we are strong. Batzel Barrett Baxter, a great servant of God, did, I think, the greatest act of all when he came back from Mayo Clinic in July of 1980 and knew that he was soon to die. Through great pain, he wrote this little autobiography. Now, I've always loved Brother Baxter. His life didn't touch me. I didn't go to Lipscomb, and so I wasn't a member of his church. And all the great service he rendered up in the years of ease, although they touched a great many people, I think that years from now, what he did in the last months of pain may be the instrument that touches more people than anything he ever did when he wrote the little autobiography, "Every Life a Plan of God." Well, we've had our glory years. We've had some pretty quiet ones recently. And a lot of people pine away for the past and talk about how we exploded from 1945 to 65 and wish we could be back there again. And it's true, we face declining churches and a shrinking pulpit. We face a lot of people who want to quit. But I tell you, the attitude ought to be, now is the time to be alive. This is not the time to pine away for a bygone glory now in the ashes. This is the time for the men of God to rise up and build. Because we build for the next generation. We build for our children and generations yet unborn. I tell you, if we do not begin to build, even out of our adversity, we will perish. We face a tough time now, but it's a great time. Because the great times are the periods of adversity and suffering. The great years of the church are 1984 on into the 21st century. Those are the great years of the church. We are very similar to England, I think, in 1940. So many people discouraged, wanting to give up. France had been overrun. Belgium had given in. The Dutch had been overwhelmed. England was ready to capitulate to Hitler. Everybody thought it was over. Everybody but one man. And finally they turned to him when all else looked bleak. He had been waiting in Parliament for over 40 years. He had grown bald and gray in his nation's service. He had endured calamity and slander and adversity of every kind. But now, with their backs to the wall, they brought him out to lead their people. And his voice came crackling across the radio airwaves, and all of the nation listened to his voice as he said, "I have nothing to offer you but blood and toil and tears and sweat." And that's what we face. And when they said to him, "Shall we give in? Shall we enter into an unholy alliance with Hitler? He has a stranglehold on all of Europe. Shall we quit?" His voice came thundering back, "We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender." And when they said to him, "Give us some sign, give us some assurance, give us some hope that we could still win out against such tremendous odds," in the greatest address he ever gave on June 18th that summer, just before the Battle of Britain, he urged his people in these memorable lines, "Let us therefore brace ourselves to our duties and so bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its Commonwealth shall last for 1,000 years, men will say, this was their finest hour." And it was. We know now that it was. They thought it was their worst hour. They were ready to quit. Many are here today across this country who bemoan the fact that churches have declined and preachers are quitting, and all the doomsayers talk about the years ahead. It's going to be pretty bleak. Let us thunder forth tonight that a new generation has come who is ready to build. Let us not pine for a bygone glory, but let us rise up and build so that others might say of this time, this was their finest hour. And if we build, we know that we build for those who are yet to come. John Milton had a dream of the England that he wanted to see, but he lived at a time of the Civil War when the people had spent their energy fighting each other. Oh, that sounds similar, brethren. With energies exhausted in the battle of having fought each other, John Milton had a dream of the England that would one day come, and in his book, The Areopagitica, he gave expression to it in these words, "Methinks I see a noble and puissant nation rousing herself like a strong man after sleep and shaking her invincible locks." Oh, the task before us is not easy. It is a noble dream. It is a dream that we could accomplish, but life will have to be transcendent in two ways if we're to do it. In the first place, we will have to transcend our own egos so that the cause will be something that we care about more than we care about our own survival. And number two, we will have to transcend it in our own brief lives so that we build for something beyond our life. I am very sure of this, that the servants of God are marching down the right road when they begin to plant shade trees under which they know full well they will never sit. We build for our children and our grandchildren. And so I close with Horatio Gates Spafford, that Chicago businessman, sending his wife and 4 daughters off on that vacation to Europe, only to find out later that at 2 o'clock in the morning of November 22nd, that beautiful French liner, the SS Villa de Havre, was rammed by that English iron sailing vessel, the Lockhearn, and in 12 minutes, the ship sank, 226 lives lost, only 57 that were saved. Mrs. Spafford clung to her 4 children, Annie, Bessie, Maggie, and Tanetta, but one by one, the overwhelming billows tore them from her grasp. Finally, only Tanetta was left, the little 2-year-old. Years later, she described this. She described how she hung and clung to her with all that she had, but the waves were too great. The little girl was torn from her grasp, and she reached out and got a hold of her gown and held her again for one last moment. But again, the overwhelming billows were too great. She was torn from her grasp, and this time when she reached out, she felt only the corduroy pant leg of a man who had been a passenger on the ship. And so when the survivors arrived at Cardiff, Wales, she cabled back her husband in the now famous 2-word cable, saved alone. It was then that he knew that all four girls had perished. He cabled his wife to meet him in Paris, not to come back alone, that he would go to her and meet her there. And then one night on the high seas, the captain came to him and said, I thought you might want to know that in just a half hour or so, we will be going over the spot where the SS Villa de Havre went down. And so he walked back to his quarters and sat in his room and wrote those memorable words on page 299. He thought of how much of his life had been lived in peace. And so he wrote, when peace like a river attendeth my way. And then he looked out the porthole and saw the billows going by. And he wrote, when sorrows like sea billows roll. Those are the two extremes. Peace doesn't often flow like a river. Sorrows don't often roll like sea billows. But whatever my lot, thou hast taught me to say, it is well. It is well with my soul. A few days later, he sat down to write his sister, Rachel, back in America, and he included this line. On Thursday last, we passed over the spot where she went down in mid-ocean, the water 3 miles deep. But I do not think of our dear ones there. They are safe, folded, the dear lambs. And there before very long shall we be too. In the meantime, thanks to God, we have an opportunity to serve and praise Him for His love and mercy to us and to ours. May we each one arise and leave all and follow Him. Isn't that a remarkable letter? There's the servant of God in the midst of great adversity. In that knowledge, we grow strong. Stronger than the storms that beat about our heads. And so we come to these words of Paul. We rejoice in our sufferings, knowing that suffering produces endurance, and endurance produces character, and character produces hope. Here is our hope. That in this generation, in this great crowd here tonight, we will not long for a time when it was easier to be a Christian, when it seemed that everything we were doing was right and success rolled after success. But now in the midst of declining churches, in the midst of a very hard time to be a Christian, in the midst of a generation with Bibles left unread on the shelves, that the servants of God will rise up and build. I think it would be appropriate to close these meditations with the thunderous singing of just the first stanza of the truly great hymn that Horatio Spafford wrote on the high seas. Will you stand together as we sing?